80775 Alvick versus District Court. Counsel, are you ready to proceed? And again, if it's more comfortable, we're socially distanced at least 20 feet each. So if you're more comfortable without your masks, feel free. And would you like to reserve any time?
I would like to reserve 2 minutes, please.
All right.
And I'll pay attention to the clock.
Okay.
Good afternoon, Justices. It's a pleasure to be before you again. And for the record, I'm Sally DeSoto from the State Public Defender's Office, and I represent Mr. Alvick on his writ today. The issues before the court today are the level of confidentiality required during a criminal settlement conference and the timing of when an evaluation pursuant to Mitchell v. State is triggered. First, we contend that the language of Supreme Court Rule 252 stating that settlement conferences must, in all respects, be confidential extends to everything learned by the other party exclusively in the settlement conference without exception.
Ms. DeSoto, yes. Sorry to cut you off so early. This is Justice Kadish. Just got a question for you, though.
Okay.
Because before we get to either of those questions you just mentioned, we have to decide whether to consider this writ, which is up on a writ as a discretionary matter.
Okay.
So given that the defense did not oppose the initial motion seeking to do this, and in fact, apparently verbally stipulated in court, and then didn't say anything until after the order was entered, and then still didn't file anything in writing giving the district court points and authorities, why should we consider this writ?
Well, we had some changes with personnel. That was the issue. The attorney that agreed to the stipulation. It was his very first day on the job when he agreed to the stipulation. It wasn't until the order came out that he noticed that the information regarding the evaluation had been garnered from the settlement conference. And that's when he requested that the hearing be held, emergency hearing be held in the district court, and then the district court evaluated whether, you know, it felt that information should come in. This was still sort of a, there was no other options that were immediately available for defendant on whether this should be considered. We felt that we hadn't triggered that evaluation through Mitchell yet because we had not given notice that we were going to use our evaluation from the expert. That's why we're hoping that you do hear this writ today and consider this writ.
So even after the first day on the job, and I hear what you're saying about that, the order itself wasn't issued until like a couple of months later. And in that interim period, counsel hadn't looked at the motion, which has attached an affidavit which makes clear exactly what it's relying on.
Elvin,
is that right?
Elvick has hundreds and thousands of pages of documents in order for somebody to review and feel that they're up to par on that case. This was trials and many appeals and many interviews, and he spent at least 100 hours trying to get caught up. And so when the order came out, it was kind of shocking to him at that point. So you have to understand that the voluminous nature of this case, it's huge. We have boxes and boxes of documents in our office. So it wasn't
But is it accurate? Is it accurate that a motion for reconsideration wasn't filed and no points and authorities were ever provided to the court in writing about why it's inappropriate to allow this exam? Is that right?
Yes, I would say that, but at the same time, you know, we're also out there on new ground. There's not a lot of case law out there. There's no case law as far as the settlement conference goes on a criminal aspect. This is a brand new statute or addition to the statute. So there wouldn't have been a lot of points and authorities anyway besides the fact, you know, the examples that we can give on why we feel this is wrong.
Right. Well, I suppose whatever arguments you've made to us could have been made to the district court.
I think it was made verbally. they made those arguments verbally. That transcript should have been attached to you on the appendix as far as the hearing.
We have the transcript. Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
So, you know, it was just done verbally. It wasn't done in writing. It was not requested to be done in writing. It was requested that because they were going to be ordering the evaluation that next week, there wasn't a lot of time to request in writing to be able to do a motion for reconsideration on that order.
Okay.
So we contend that the language on 252 stating that settlement conference must in all respects be confidential, extend to everything. And the examples the DA had given, one of them was that if the prosecutor learns of an alibi witness during the conference, can he not then go interview the witnesses? And we claim no, they can't until they're noticed 10 days before trial of those witnesses and whether we're going to use it. In another example, the district attorney mentions an erased lapel cam video and whether the defense can then go act on that and file spoliation motion. We would have already known about that. We investigate that. That's something that we would have learned outside of the settlement conference and not specifically there. The confidentiality promised in Supreme Court Rule 252 is what gives the defendant faith to share information in the first place. I mean, if they've gotten to that point where we're doing a criminal settlement conference, they have exercised their right to trial for quite a while, and they don't really have any, you know, motive to participate in a settlement conference. If the district attorney is then going to take information from them that to build their case, and we as counsel would surely not advise our clients to participate. Justice Hardesty, did you have a question?
Yes, I did. Thanks, Mr. Soto. As I understand it, there's two issues surrounding, or two factual questions surrounding the state's ability to go secure an expert and look into this. One, of course, is the intention of the defendant to put his or her mental state at issue. And then the second is the intention to retain an expert to address that. As to the first point, on page 5 of Judge Russell's order, he recites the fact that in the motion to dismiss by Mr. Elbick, after having his conviction overturned by the federal court, he filed a motion to dismiss. And in that motion to dismiss, it was represented to the state and to the court that one issue at the upcoming trial will be whether at the time of this incident, Mr. Elbick knew the wrongfulness of his actions. Did not that put his mental state at issue, setting aside the confidentiality protections of Rule 252?
Well, and that certainly is a question. Does that, the Ninth Circuit held that that was certainly an element that the district attorney had to prove, but that had sort of to do with his age. And it's not like Estes v. State or where it was insanity and it was an affirmative defense, or Mitchell v. State where it was an affirmative defense. That is something that we're not really quite sure if that puts his mental state at issue. And until we notice 21 days that we're going to be using this expert, then we may just be sitting back and waiting to see whether the district attorney can prove their case.
I'm just trying to clarify whether what is the nature of the confidentiality problem under 252. It looks to me like Mr. Elvick's intention to express his mental state was known by the parties and known outside of the settlement negotiations in under 252. What may not have been known was whether he had retained an expert to address this.
Right.
I'm trying to clarify what it was that was divulged in the 252 that's problematic that wasn't already available in some other part of the record?
Well, it certainly was, you know, divulged that we had retained an expert, and it was beneficial to us at that point. But as we were stating, we didn't feel that Mr. Elvick's age and whether he knew the wrongfulness was necessarily an affirmative defense, and whether we could be using that on rebuttal or whether the state would be using an evaluation on rebuttal, that's all defense theory that we haven't laid out at this point yet, or hadn't at that point. So, you know, whether that's triggered when they find out that we've hired an expert, or whether that's triggered because it's determined that is his mental state that we've put forward, or is naturally part of the case,
is it your argument, counsel, that only an affirmative defense can trigger the right for the state to do an exam, rather than if there's a challenge to the ability to have the mental state required for the state to prove the elements of the crime?
No, certainly not. I mean, where we give notice that we had the expert and we were planning on using the expert during, you know, our rebuttal case, then we have to present that expert opinion, and then that would also trigger at that point the ability for the state to have him evaluated.
Thank you.
Okay. And that's the other thing, as I think we've kind of discussed it, is the triggering. We just don't know at that point whether we're going to use it, or whether 21 days before trial, when it's required, that they can then request that he be evaluated. As I've stated, this is fairly new ground, so I'm going to, unless you have other questions, I'm going to go ahead and let Mr. Woodbury take over the podium at this point.
Thank you. May it please the court. Jason Woodbury, Carson City District Attorney, appearing on behalf of Real Party in Interest, the state of Nevada. We are asking the court to deny the petition before it today for four reasons. First, the petition advocates an interpretation of Rule 252 that the language of that rule does not support. Second, the petition proposes a comprehensive blanket of absolute confidentiality that is incompatible with the ethical and constitutional obligations and duties of a prosecutor and defense counsel in a criminal case. Third, there is no rational basis for a mandated artificial confidentiality concerning information that is required by statute to be disclosed, irrespective of whether a criminal settlement conference occurs or not. And the fourth and final reason we ask the court to deny the petition is that the Mitchell precedent controls the circumstances of this case. Mitchell establishes three essential conditions that trigger the state's right to have the defendant compelled to present himself for an examination by the state's expert. Those three conditions are that the defendant's mental state are at issue in the case, that secondly, the defense has engaged an expert and presented the defendant to that expert for a personal examination, and third, that the expert will testify at trial. All three of those conditions exist in this case, perfecting the state's right to have the defendant present himself for a personal examination by the state's expert. That's what the district court ordered, and that's what we would ask the court to allow that examination to proceed in this case. So those are the four reasons.
Mr. Woodbury, this is Justice Hardesty, if I may interrupt you.
Yes.
When and how was the second factor in Mitchell satisfied in this case by Elvick? That is to say, under what circumstances, through what mechanism, and at what time did Elvick inform the state of his expert and his retention of an expert and that report?
The report itself has not been disclosed. The information, as it's indicated in the record, most specifically the declaration to the motion for the compelled examination, that particular information that the defense had engaged an expert and that they had submitted the defendant to a personal examination of that expert, that was disclosed by counsel for the defendant directly to counsel for the state in the during one of the sessions of the settlement conference that was conducted.
Well, I guess what I'm trying to understand, help me if you would here, under Mitchell, and by the way, I'm kind of assuming, as I suggested to Ms. DeSoto, that the mental state of the defendant was an issue and had been an issue and was an issue on following the federal court's decision. So that part, I think, of Mitchell seems to be pretty well known in the case. What I'm trying to understand is when, under Mitchell, does the defendant's disclosure about the expert invoke the state's ability to pursue this remedy? It seems like there's a couple of choices. One might be where there's an informal communication from defense counsel to the state that the expert's been retained. Another, perhaps more strict approach is to not allow the state to have that second factor addressed until Elvick makes his disclosure under NRS 174-234-2. And so I'm just wondering if the question here was premature until the expert is actually officially notified by statute and as required by statute. Seems like this process was a bit premature. Could you comment on that, please?
I can. Thank you, Justice Hardiston. And Mitchell answers that very question. There is nothing in Mitchell to suggest that the quote-unquote official notification required by Nevada statute that this is an expert where the defense is going to call, that is a condition that must be met before the state is entitled to move forward with a compelled examination. As a matter of fact, a close reading of Mitchell pretty clearly indicates that the court in the district court in that case that this court affirmed ordered a compelled examination by the state's expert in advance of that expert notice happening. And the reason we know that from Mitchell is because one of the claims by Mitchell is that the state hadn't provided proper expert notice in accordance with that 21-day statute. So it must have been allowed to conduct the examination in advance of that. Mitchell stands for the proposition that there are three conditions that must exist, and I've mentioned those conditions. The mental state is at issue. The defense has an expert they've presented for the defendant for a personal examination, and the expert is going to testify at trial. At the moment those three exist under the Mitchell precedent, that perfects the state's right to have the defendant compelled to submit himself for an examination. Now, the defense can change their mind. There is no limit on the defense's ability to change their mind. All they have to do is indicate in some form or fashion that we've changed our mind. This expert that we had is not going to testify for whatever reason. Maybe we don't want to present the defendant to the state's expert for whatever reason. They can and have, there's no limit on their ability to do that. But they have to make a decision. They don't have a due process right to simply defer that decision once the Mitchell right has been perfected.
So I guess maybe I am trying to clarify something, because I've read Mitchell a couple of different times, and I don't see in Mitchell where there's a requirement that the defense disclose that they've retained and have an expert report. Instead, it seems like in the court's examination of the second factor, and the second factor is whether the examination strikes a fair state individual balance, that it is assessing whether it's necessary to have the state get an expert to address this, and whether the examination is the most reliable means for the state to assess the defendant's culpability. So designation of expert doesn't seem to be a part of those, that factor of those three tests.
I agree with that 100%. They are, it is apples and oranges. The requirements are often associated, obviously, because absent, you know, a pre-notice disclosure by the defense, the first time the state's going to know about an expert witness that's personally examined the defendant is that notice. But that practical nexus does not translate into a legal right. Nothing in Mitchell translates that practical nexus into a legal right to defer that decision until the last possible moment. Mitchell just does not, cannot be interpreted that way. You're absolutely right, Justice Hardesty. Subsection, in regard to the language of Rule 252, subsection C of Section 2 of that rule frames the issue in this dispute. That subsection states, quote, settlement conferences must, in all respects, be confidential and not reported or recorded. That provision, in both its verbiage and in its context, refers to a settlement conference as an event. It does not reference communications exchanged in the course of the settlement conference, and it certainly does not reference information learned during a settlement conference. Those were not inadvertent omissions in the rule. This court meant exactly what it said when it articulated this rule in this way. And we know this based on the language itself, but it becomes especially evident when you compare this language with the language of another rule from this court. NRAP 16H provides for confidentiality in the settlement conference program for civil appeals. That rule does specifically reference communications and states in pertinent part, quote, matters discussed at the settlement conference and papers or documents prepared under this rule shall not be admissible in evidence in any judicial proceeding and shall not be subject to discovery. So it's not, it can't be credibly argued that this court neglected or forgot to specifically address communications. The confidentiality requirement was specifically intended to apply to the event of a settlement conference, that it's not going to be open to the public, that it's not going to be recorded or reported. That event, that's talking about the global event, not about communications. And that intention is precisely reflected in the text of the rule, and it directly refutes the petition in this case. We also know,
Mr. Woodbury?
Yes, Justice
Cage. Mr. Woodbury, this is Justice Cage.
Yes.
Would you agree that it would be inappropriate to raise, for this, you on behalf of the state to raise at trial some offer of settlement proposed by the defendant at the settlement conference?
I would agree with that, Justice Kadish, and I, if I can expand on that, I'd like to.
Please.
That particular circumstance is addressed in NRS 48.105, which states in pertinent part, evidence of conduct or statements made in compromise negotiations is likewise not admissible. It's not admissible, as you said, as some sort of an admission at trial. But that comes in through 48.105 and not this rule itself. And 48.105 addresses specifically the admission of evidence in at a trial in this case. So that's an important supplement to Rule 252, and it works in perfect harmony with what Rule 252 is intended to accomplish.
Thank you.
Thank you. So we also know that the misinterpretation of Rule 252 is correct because it makes sense in the context of a criminal case. I would submit as a fundamental premise to this, that there cannot be two standards of confidentiality under Rule 252. That is, there cannot be one standard that applies to the defense and a different standard that applies to the prosecution. It has to be a uniform standard. And once you accept that premise, the petition's faulty argument is exposed. This is really easier, from my perspective, to understand if you look at it from the defense perspective. It is not difficult at all to imagine important information being disclosed at a criminal settlement conference that's going to compel some action by the defense attorney. We provided some examples in the answer. My colleague on the other side referenced a couple. But imagine that body cam footage is inadvertently destroyed and that information is disclosed during a settlement conference. Or imagine that an important defense witness has moved out of state, unbeknownst to the defense, but the prosecution has information about that witness's whereabouts and discloses that. Now, if this court accepts the petition's comprehensive, absolute confidentiality principle, and you also say that the petition that wants to put that on the prosecution has to also accept that on the part of the defense attorney, you have a defense attorney who's not going to be able to act on that information. And the question then becomes, how can you square that lack of action with the Sixth Amendment's guarantee of effective assistance of counsel? And I respectfully submit that you can't. The ultimate purpose of the criminal justice process is to accomplish a just and fair adjudication as efficiently as reasonably practicable. The petition's request would invite litigants to escalate strategic tactics into obstructive gamesmanship. May I finish?
Yes, you may.
That should not be allowed by this court. The petition should be denied. Thank you.
All right. Colleagues, do you have any additional questions for Mr. Woodbury?
No, thank you.
Jim, just I'm hard to see. I think you're on it. Mute.
We've got to operate this thing. My apologies. No, thank you, Mr. Woodbury.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. And Mr. Soto, you got 3 minutes, 25 seconds for rebuttal.
And it seems like he only went through the first two mentioned four things that he was going to attach, but I want to. In all respects, in the language of 252, I think in all respects speaks for itself. In all respects is not listed in any of the other statutes as far as civil cases and whether their settlement conference language is going to be available or you can act on them. And the problem here is that when he talks about a uniform standard, when we go into that settlement conference, we pretty much know what they're going to be arguing at the case. There are no surprises that they are allowed to spring on us. But at the same time, we have the right to withhold what our theory is until we need to give notice. So the person that gains by us giving information is the district attorney. We don't have anything to gain by any information they can give us that we don't already know.
So, Ms. DeSoto, so is your position that under any circumstances that this Mitchell right doesn't kick in unless and until there's the official statutory disclosure?
That would be true. Yes, we would.
So, what if it wasn't at a settlement conference, but you were, as often happens, around the phone with Mr. Woodbury, talking about this case, maybe trying to work out some kind of plea deal for your client, and you mentioned to him in that context, you know, we got an expert who's examined Mr. Elvick and is going to say X, Y, and Z at trial. Sure. Are you saying he couldn't use that to file a motion?
No, that would be shame on us for speaking in something that's not in a confidential nature.
So it could be used even though it's not the official statutory disclosure.
If it's something that he learned outside of the settlement conference, that's bad on us. We have no argument against that. We have no grievance that we can file against that. But where it's learned in the settlement conference, and then they take it and they act on that before we've given notice what our theory of defense is, yes, then we think that in all aspects they should not be able to use that.
And was this communicated directly by defense counsel to the prosecutor, as opposed to being said to the settlement judge with a statement, you know, don't tell them this, but this is what's happened?
No, I believe.
How did that?
It was okay. Translated directly to the district attorney.
Okay.
That, as far as I know, I was not there, and there are no recordings, and there's no record of it. But that's what my assumption is. So, is there any other questions?
Colleagues, any other questions?
No, thank you,
not
Mr.
Sutter.
Thank you very much.
All right, counsel, thank you for your time. Thank you for the briefs in this matter. And it will stand submitted, and the court will stand in recess until the next call.